A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Ram, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on May 24, 1998, in the series Christian Faith, Interpretations of Experience, entitled The End of the Story. The texts for the sermon are Micah 4, verses 1 through 5, and John 20, verses 19 through 23. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
I had a dear old custodian in the church I served in New Jersey. Came to church one time with a cold. He said, "Why don't you take your clothes off and go roll in the snow?" I said, "Gee, I'll get pneumonia." He said, "That's right. They can do something with pneumonia." Well, I've been fussing around with something since Florida, and I don't know, it goes around here and there, and you probably know my throat's been funny, and now it's busted out in my head, and Nancy says, "Why don't you go to the doctor? Why don't you go to the doctor? Why don't you go to the doctor?" I think I'm going to go to the doctor. So I got a fever and I got a headache. I feel lousy, can't focus, and you might as well have gone to the beach. But I didn't want it to be for nothing, because I did want to take an offering, and so I have a guest preacher. The guest preacher this morning is Paul Harvey.
A most extraordinary document came over the internet the other day. I did not write it. It is identified only as an open letter from God. I don't dare not repeat it. From now on, I'm quoting an open letter from God. My dear children, and believe me, that is all of you, I consider myself a pretty patient guy. I mean, look at the Grand Canyon. It took millions of years to get it right. And about evolution, boy, nothing is slower than designing that whole Darwinian thing to take place, cell by cell, gene by gene. And I have been patient through your fashions, your civilizations, wars and schemes, and the countless ways that you take me for granted until you get yourselves into big trouble again and again. I want to let you know about some of the things that started ticking me off. First of all, your religious rivalries are driving me up a wall. Enough already. Let's get one thing straight. These are your religions, not mine. I'm the whole enchilada. I'm beyond them all. Every one of your religions claims that there's only one of me, which, by the way, is absolutely true. But in the very next breath, each religion claims that it's my favorite one. And each claims its Bible was written personally by me and that all of the other Bibles are man-made. Oh, me. How do I ever begin to put a stop to such complicated nonsense? All right. Listen up now. I am your father and mother. And I don't play favorites among my children. Also, I hate to break it to you, but I don't write. My longhand is awful, and I've always been more of a doer anyway. So all of your books, including those Bibles, were written by men and women. They were inspired men and women. They were remarkable people. But they also made mistakes here and there, and I made sure of that so that you would never trust a written word rather than your own living heart. You see, one human being to me, even a bum on the street, is worth more than all of the holy books in the world. That's just the kind of a guy I am. My spirit is not an historical thing. It's alive right now, as fresh as your next breath. Holy books and religious rites are sacred and powerful, but they are not more so than the least of you. They were only meant to steer you in the right direction, not to keep you arguing with each other, and certainly not to keep you from trusting your own personal connection with me. Which brings me to my next point about your nonsense. You act like I need you and your religions to stick up for me or win souls. For my sake, please don't do me any favors. I can stand quite well on my own, thank you. I don't need you to defend me. I don't need constant credit. I just want you to be good to each other. And another thing, I don't get all worked up over money or politics, so stop dragging my name into your dramas. For example, I swear to me that I never threatened Oral Roberts. I never rode in any of Rajneesh's Rolls Royces, and I never told Pat Robertson to run for president, and I have never, ever had a conversation with Jim Baker or Jerry Falwell or Jimmy Swaggart. Of course, come Judgment Day, I certainly intend to. Now, the thing is, I want you to stop thinking of religion as some sort of a loyalty pledge to me. The true purpose of your religions is so that you can become more aware of me, not the other way around. Believe me, I know you already. I know what's in each of your hearts. And I love you anyway, with no strings attached. So lighten up and enjoy me. That's what religion's best for. What you seem to forget is how mysterious I am. You look at the petty differences in your scriptures and you say, well, if this is the truth, then that can't be. But instead of trying to figure out my paradoxes and unfathomable nature, which, by the way, you never will, why not open your hearts to the simple common threads of every religion? You know what I'm talking about. Play nice with each other. Love and respect everyone. Be kind. Even when life is scary or confusing, take courage and be of good cheer, for I'm always with you. And learn how to be quiet so that you can hear my still, small voice. I don't like to shout. Leave the world a better place by living your life with dignity and gracefulness. For you are my own child. Hold back nothing from life. For the parts of you that can die surely will, and the parts that can't won't. So don't worry. Be happy. I stole that last line from Bobby McFerrin, but who gave it to him in the first place? Simple stuff now. Why do you keep making it so complicated? It's like you're always looking for an excuse to be upset. And I am very tired of your main excuse. Do you think I care whether you call me God or Yahweh or Jehovah, Allah, Wakatonka, Brahma, Father, Mother, even the void of Nirvana? Do you think I care which of my special children you feel closest to, Jesus, Mary, Buddha, Krishna, Muhammad, or any of the others? You can call me and my special ones any name you choose, if only you will go about my business of loving one another as I love you. How can you keep neglecting something so simple? No, I am not telling you to abandon your religions. Enjoy your religions. Honor them. Learn from them, just as you should enjoy, honor, and learn from your parents. But do you walk around telling everyone that your parents are better than theirs? Your religion, like your parents, may always have the most special place in your heart. I don't mind that at all. And I don't want you to combine all of the great traditions into one big mess. Each religion is unique for a reason. Each has a unique style so that people can find the best path for themselves. But, my special children, the ones that your religions revolve around, all live in the same place, in my heart. And they get along perfectly, I assure you. The clergy must stop creating a myth of sibling rivalry where there is none. My blessed children of earth, the world has grown too small for your pervasive religious bigotries and confusion. The whole planet is now connected by air travel, satellite dishes, telephones, fax machines, rock concerts, diseases, and mutual needs and concerns. Get with the program. If you really want to help me celebrate the birthday of my son Jesus, then commit yourselves to figuring out how to feed your hungry and clothe your naked and protect your abused and shelter your poor. And just as important, make your own everyday life a shining example of kindness and good humor. I've given you all the resources you need if only you abandon your fear of each other and begin living and loving and laughing together. Finally, my children everywhere, remember whose birthday you honor on what you call Christmas Day, December 25, and the fearlessness with which he chose to live and die. As I love him, so do I love each of you. Now, I am not really ticked off. Not really. I just wanted to grab your attention because I hate to see you suffer. But I gave you free will. So what can I do now other than try to influence you through reason, persuasion, and a little old-fashioned guilt and manipulation? After all, you know, I am the original Jewish mother. I just want you to be happy. And I'll sit in the dark. I really am, indeed, I swear, with you always, always. Trust in me. Your one and only God.
Well, it isn't really that I ought to be in intensive care rather than sitting here that I played that. I wanted to play it. I intended to play it because someone accused me of writing it, which I didn't do, but I wish I had, for the most part at least. On this Memorial Day weekend, which is also the last Sunday in Eastertide, we are going to say one more time that our Christian tradition is the interpretation of experience. And the foundational event of the Christian tradition is Easter. It was the experience of those who knew that Jesus, the one they had loved and followed and had hoped would be their deliverer, was crucified, and then, strangely enough, experienced still as alive. Peter, Paul, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of Jesus, all of them. The Christian tradition coming out of the womb of Judaism was the consequence of interpreting the experience of the living Lord. All religion is the interpretation of human experience. It is the consequence of our trying to make sense out of our human situation. In those moments when we come to an awareness, a consciousness of the holy, of the sacred, of God. In those moments of awareness, in that experience, we seek then to understand what is going on. What has been said to us? What has broken through to us? And that ongoing interpretation of experience, which initially is written down in the immediate wake of the foundational event, but then which written record continues to create the possibility for the experience to happen again and again and again, because we're dealing with the living Lord who gave us the Spirit. So that the Christian tradition is now 2,000 years old, and it is the interpretation of the experience of the presence of Jesus, who we declare to be Lord of all. That the way of Jesus was the way of God, that the truth of Jesus was the truth of God, and that the life of Jesus was the life of God. And so, what is the end of it all? Or the purpose of the story that we have now been telling for 2,000 years? The story that has been told and retold for 2,000 years and has been told to us and that we continue to tell. What is the end of it all? I want to say this morning on this Memorial Day weekend that the end of it all is peace on earth. Or that beautiful Hebrew word which is too rich to interpret with one English word. The end of it all is shalom. the totality of reality in total harmony between creator and creature, creator and creation, creature and creation, in the totality of that mix, perfect harmony reflecting the intention of God. That is the purpose or the end of the gospel. The scriptures are focused on the here and now. Our faith is this worldly faith. To be sure, we have tended to project it beyond history to another time and another place. But to read the scriptures is to be aware that it is about this world and its transformation. It is about the mending of creation. The Hebrew prophets gave us visions that are marvelous. If you would go down to the worship center this year, you would have seen here and there lions and lambs, because the wonderful vision of the prophet Isaiah, 2nd Isaiah, was that the time would come when a new creation in which the lion and the lamb would lie down together. As Woody Allen said, when they sleep, the lion will sleep more soundly than the lamb. Nonetheless, the lion and the lamb lying down together, symbolic of that harmony that has come over all things. Or the picture in the prophetic reading this morning from Micah, where Mount Zion will be exalted, will be lifted up, and the nations will flow to Jerusalem, and out of Jerusalem, out of Mount Zion, will flow the Torah, the law, but the Torah, the way of life. And the purpose of Israel, its specific function, was to be the instructor of the nations, to give light to the nations. And the prophet says that when Israel is exalted, when Mount Zion is exalted, and when the nations come and receive instruction in Torah, then there will be righteousness and peace. Then they will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks, and nation will not lift up sword against nation, nor will they learn war anymore. The prophetic vision is about this world, about creation, about history, about concrete human experience. And the end of the story, the biblical story, is that there might be peace. On Memorial Day, we remember those who paid the supreme price and the sacrifice in order that there might be peace. And we have enjoyed so much as a nation. But we have still, in this world of ours, so far to go. The prophetic vision is a challenge to us. When the experience of Jesus' death and resurrection was Paul's experience, he tried to figure out the timetable and what was going to happen. He talked about how Jesus was raised from the dead as the first fruits of those who would be raised. Paul expected that he was at the end of the age, the new age would dawn. Paul expected that this Jesus who had been raised was in the presence of God temporarily, only to return and to restore all things. There was at present, the major victory had been won, but there was at present a mopping up operation. Then, when Jesus finally subdued all things, then Jesus would yield up the kingdom to God, and then God would be everything to everyone. Paul expected it to happen any moment. He was wrong about that, his timetable, his calendar. If you read the 15th chapter of 1 Corinthians, you find that Paul was straining to understand the phenomenon of resurrection, and he would have been better off just to proclaim it rather than the torturous way in which he went on to talk about it. He was wrong about how this all was going to work out, and I can't believe that for 2,000 years we haven't simply recognized that fact. But what we see in it, what he was trying to do, was to say that what happened in Jesus was critical for the whole destiny of the universe, for the world, the cosmos, and that eventually there would be this kingdom of God or this reign of God. I like the picture that we have in the fourth gospel of that Easter evening when Jesus is suddenly in the midst of the disciples who are clammed up in a locked room, afraid for their lives. And he says, "Peace to you." And they determine that it really is their living Lord. And he says, "Peace to you. As the Father has sent me, so send I you." Paul was just a couple of decades down the line. He was still expecting the heavens to open. The writer of the fourth gospel is some 6 decades down the line. He's beginning to say, maybe we've got to adjust our understanding of what's going on in the world. But the point of the fourth gospel, in the light of the resurrection, the interpretation of that experience was that as Jesus was in the world, so the followers of Jesus were to be. As the Father has sent me, so send I you. If Jesus is the enfleshment, if Jesus is the enfleshment of the Word of God, if Jesus is the human face of God, if Jesus is the embodiment of God in historical garb, then what Jesus says in the fourth gospel to us is that what I am here, you are to be here. And that is to say, peace be unto you. To bring about that shalom on earth, the mending of creation, it is the task here and now in our lives as a community of faith to be peacemakers, to create, to embody in community that mending of relationships and that totality of harmony in our lives and in our lives together that will be a sign of the kingdom of God, and do what we can to promote that peace in the world. In the middle of April, the Time magazine came with the first of 6 special editions that will come out over the next 2 years. Perhaps you've seen it. This century, the 20th century, leaders and revolutionaries. And this being the first, there was an introductory essay indicating the nature of our 20th century, which the writer claims is one of the 4 or 5 most significant centuries. And we're living at the end of it. He mentions, for example, the 15th century. You've got the Renaissance, you've got the Spanish Inquisition, you've got Copernicus looking at the heavens, you've got the Gutenberg printing press developed. Very, very significant, world-shaking, age-determining events. Or the first century, of course, with Jesus, death and resurrection. Or the 5th century B.C., Plato, Aristotle, the whole Greek philosophical thinking. But the writer makes a pretty good case, I think, for the fact that our 20th century is one of those significant times. Over the years, I have called it a hinge period, a hinge time. You know all these things, but just listen as he ticks off some of the things that mark our century. To name just a few random things we did in 100 years, we split the atom, invented jazz and rock, launched airplanes and landed on the moon, concocted a general theory of relativity, devised the transistor, and figured out how to etch millions of them in tiny microchips, discovered penicillin and structure of DNA, fought down fascism and communism, developed cinema and television, built highways and wired the world, not to mention the peripherals these produced, such as sitcoms and cable channels, 800 numbers, websites, shopping malls, leisure time, existentialism, modernism, Oprah. And he says, against all odds, we avoided blowing ourselves up. What a time in which to be alive. One of the most significant centuries in which to be a participant. A fascinating time. With all of that happening, is there any wonder that people are afraid, have lost their moorings? So that we see a double reaction in society at large. We see on the one hand a kind of a pessimistic relativism that throws up its hands and sees no guiding star. And on the other hand, we see a kind of fanatical reactionism, a fundamentalism that wants to turn the clock back and to go back and find a safe place in which to dwell, not understanding that there is no safe place in which to dwell in the house of history, and that one can never go home, one can never go backward. And it is the people of God, it is the Church of Jesus Christ that ought to be at the forefront with confidence, leading the way, breaking new ground with a beacon into the future, wondering at the awesomeness of our life and our world, and moving things onward rather than generating fear and eliciting negative emotions from people. The prophet Micah, in the passage to which I referred a moment ago, after speaking about how the nations will flow to Mount Zion to be instructed and go home and live in peace, says, "And the nations and the peoples will walk in the name of their God, and we will walk in the name of the Lord our God, Yahweh our God." In other words, in that moment when Israel was to be the teacher of the nations, they were not bringing everybody into the Jewish faith. They were saying to everybody, practice your own faith, practice your own rituals, pray in your own way, in your own posture, in your own good time. Be who you are, but learn those basic fundamental principles of righteousness and justice that are the foundation of human society. And those principles, which have manifested themselves so marvelously in Western civilization and in the United States of America in our history, those principles of democratic liberalism, the freedom of the individual, the possibility of pursuing one's own way in worship and in work, the wonderful freedom that has enabled us to accomplish tremendous goals, and the kinds of things that we have brought about and accomplished and have at our hand today are not things that simply will go down in history as just another interesting century. They are the kinds of discoveries. We are on the kind of move that will open up the world as never before. The growth will be exponential. The understanding, the insights, if we don't blow ourselves up, and we could, but we will blow ourselves up if we allow the religious fundamentalisms of the world to create fear and drive to violence. It is for the Church of Jesus Christ to recognize on this Memorial Day weekend, this end of Eastertide, that all of our interpretation of tradition is the consequence of our concrete experience. And that is true for us, and it is true for every people everywhere. In this article, it says the things that we have to worry about as we go into the next century, two of them, tribalism, fundamentalism. And it is fundamentally important for the Church of Jesus Christ to recognize that the whole purpose and end of its story is peace. That its whole biblical story is about shalom, about the mending of creation, about the ultimate kingdom of God, the reign of God in peace, where there is righteousness and justice. The church is called, I think, as never before, to a radical discipleship. As the Father has sent me, the embodiment of the divine in the human, calling for justice, compassion, loving of the enemy, turning the other cheek, the way of nonviolence, laying down finally one's life if need be. That's the radical demand of the followers of Jesus who would be in this world as Jesus was. which I think is the end and purpose of it all. Finally, to be a peacemaker. And Paul Harvey wasn't so far off. It's relatively simple. If we dared trust our intuitions, if we dared trust our heart, if we dared recognize the limitations of this book, the fact that it has not fallen out of heaven with an authoritarian grasp upon us so that every move we make and every word we utter, we have to somehow or other square it with this book. That's authoritarian religion that creates more havoc on earth than peace. It is time for us to wrestle with the biblical story again, to take serious 2,000 years of tradition, to trust our experience, and to use our heads. And to be good to one another with good humor and grace and a lot of kindness and compassion. Finally, dear friends, that's what it's all about. Heaven can wait. That can't.